Since the Symphony No. 2 by Mahler is being presented without intermission, here is Klaus Roy with a pre-performance feature. Klaus?
Thank you, Robert. It is almost exactly 1 year since we talked with Eugene Ormandy, the great conductor appearing as guest with the Cleveland Orchestra. And again, we have the privilege of speaking with this extraordinary artist who is now in his 37th season on the podium of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Mr. Ormandy, when last we spoke, we discussed a whole variety of things, including your amazing tenure in Philadelphia, the special sound that you've cultivated there, the over 400 recordings you've made, and the numerous composers you have championed. We also spoke about Mahler's first symphony, which you were then conducting here. Perhaps in the light of what we are about to hear in this program, the second symphony of Mahler, we might talk about that composer and your special relationship to him. I think it's a very long one, your relation to Mahler, and particularly the second.
Actually, the relationship is more to Mrs. Mahler, the widow, because by the time I became conductor of the Minneapolis Orchestra, he was long dead. And in my early years in Minneapolis, it was between 1931 and 36. And I always used to go to Vienna on my summer, for my summer vacations with my wife. I've always heard in Vienna, why don't you play more Mahler? Why don't Americans play Mahler? Why don't I like Mahler in America? I said, pick one and give me one. I don't know any of them, just excepting from hearing. So why don't you take the second? That's the most beautiful of them all. I said, all right, I'll take the second. So what nobody knows, because I have never told this to anyone, just about that time, Alban Berg and I became very close friends. We had summer homes very close to each other in Salzkammergut in Austria. And he used to come to visit us, especially because he was just given a Steyr automobile. That's the Austrian automobile.
Yes, the little one.
And he was so proud of it, he wanted to show it off. He was very childish in these respects, but his greatness nevertheless was recognized by the whole world by then. And I said to him, I said, you knew Mahler very well. I said, I have no idea about this symphony. Give me some ideas. Supposing I'll sing for you some of the melodies, and you tell me the tempi and interpretation. He says, as a matter of fact, I know the Mahler second very well, and I've been with him many times, and so I know what he wanted. So he was a tremendous help, and I still have a score where he wrote down metronomic markings, which are entirely different from what I had before given to me by so-called Mahler disciples.
Of course, his colleague Webern often conducted the second symphony.
Oh yes, but Webern, I didn't know personally.
Yes.
He was a very strange man, as you probably knew, and Berg was a very outgoing person. So it just so happened that we met, and I asked him, and I also went to Universal Edition, where the symphony, all the symphonies were published, and talked with the conductor in charge there. And he also, I wanted to make sure I give the as authentic a performance of it, tempo-wise, interpretation-wise, as anyone can give the first time in his life. And they gave me some ideas, and I realized that they were so different from what Berg gave, and his was so different from what they gave, believing that they knew exactly what Mahler wanted, that I realized I have to make up my own mind about
yes.
tempi and interpretation. But they helped me very much to really find the center of the tempi and interpretation and that whole thing. And you didn't have to look at the score very long to really feel part of it and be enthused about the greatness of the work and of the composer. Then I took it to Minneapolis, that I faced difficulties such as I had five horns. Four horns at an assistant first. I had four trumpets, not all top quality, in a small city in those days, and three trombones only. In other words, and three each woodwind, and this orchestration calls for tremendously large apparatus. And I sat down, and that helped also tremendously for my understanding the piece, that I put in about 1,000 or more little cued notes. not realizing that everybody will be playing all the time, and they won't even have a breathing spell for four or five measures. And it was really, but I was young, I was terribly enthusiastic, I wanted to introduce Mahler at best. And the musicians were running back and forth, backstage front, because for backstage calls, and I worked it out I worked it out in perfect detail, but I didn't have an assistant, as we had here in Cleveland, who would conduct the backstage music. And short circuit television didn't exist in those days.
Yes.
So I worked out a method. I wouldn't dare to do it today. And in fact, when I think of it, I start to worry 38 years later how I dare to do this. I had on my podium lights, little buttons in front of me, and each button was a signal for one or another group. So while I was conducting, and it's all they always play against the beat backstage, as I was conducting, I was giving signals to them, the whole thing. Of course, I worked about 3 months on it. I memorized the whole thing from A to Z. And it turned out to be really an unforgettable experience. I had a chorus of 500. And you know what the Scandinavians start to sing. They do sing beautifully. Wonderful.
Twin City chorus.
It was a, in those days there was no Twin City. They were enemies. They didn't talk to each other.
It had a name like that, I thought.
It wasn't. It could have been.
Circum, I think.
Oh, you probably read the.
If that's the same that you did for the recording.
Well, I performed at the performance. They recorded it.
Yes.
They were already claiming to be so poor they couldn't afford to record this large, large scale work, expensive work. So we had to do it at the recording.
At the performance.
At the performance. Yes.
In January of 1935.
Oh my God! You know
yeah,
that
I
too.
Yeah, I know the. I have the record.
Oh, you do have the record.
I was recording. I can tell you that. When I was a student at Harvard many, many centuries ago, that was my first experience of a Mahler symphony, your old 78 RPM recording of the second. And I listened to it in a room about as large as this table, if you can imagine that sound coming in a tiny little room.
It was surprisingly well produced. The acoustics were surprisingly good for the recording, not for the hall. The concert hall was too big for a concert hall. But it turned out as a good recording. RCA Victor always made good recordings way back. I remember that. And what is really important of this whole conversation is the fact that that record, or those records, there was a whole album, about 15 records, I think, they were sent to Mrs. Mahler to Vienna, where she lived with her new husband.
Franz Werfel, the novelist.
Yes. And when we got to Vienna that summer, next summer, my wife and I found an invitation for supper in a cottage where they had the villa, and there were maybe 300 people invited there, all important in the musical world, because all of them said the first recording of Mahler had to be done in America by a small orchestra, an unknown orchestra. In fact, one of the critics said to me, until I saw the announcement that you recorded it in Minneapolis, I was asking, what is Minneapolis? Do you eat it? He told it to me himself.
Unbelievable.
Yes, it was Joseph Marx, the well-known critic and composer.
Yes, good song composer, too.
Yes, very good.
It's interesting that you mentioned Berg, because the connection between Berg and Mahler and the whole family is so interesting and so intense. Just a week before we talk, we had the Berg Violin Concerto, which, of course, is dedicated to the memory of Manon Gropius,
of
who
course.
Was the daughter of Alma Mahler,
yes.
the second husband. So
to an angel, isn't it?
Yes, the memory
dedicated
of an angel.
To an angel.
You've often conducted it. The second symphony is an extraordinary piece, which I think we will be hearing. Even those to whom that work is new over the air cannot fail to be overwhelmed by it. Do you find that the second has a very special meaning for you, not only because of that early recording, but among the 9 or 10 symphonies?
Of course, every one of them is a very great masterpiece, but the second I have to associate with my first performance of it, because I have never forgotten it. And it always inspired me every time I do it, not as often as I would like to do it, but it really still takes a little pushing of local managers and other people to allow the second Mahler to be brought to performance.
I wish our time would allow us to discuss all of them in order, because last year you did the first with us, this year you're doing the second. That would mean that by about 1980 we would have the 10th, which you recently recorded.
Yes.
If you did one each year, but unfortunately our time is running out. It's been a very great privilege for us to talk with Eugene Ormandy, the guest conductor in this concert, and we thank him for finding time on a very busy day of performance to talk with us.
Nothing could give me greater pleasure, believe me.
Thank you so much, and now back to Robert Conrad.
Thank you, Klaus. In a moment, we'll hear the Mahler Symphony No. 2, conducted by Eugene Ormandy. On this concert by the Cleveland Orchestra, we're to hear a complete performance of the Mahler Symphony No. 2, the Resurrection Symphony. Joining the orchestra and Eugene Ormandy will be the Cleveland Orchestra Chorus and soloist Veronica Tyler, soprano, and Helen Watts, contralto. Here is Eugene Ormandy.